Welcome to the Green Minds podcast, the podcast dedicated to thought-provoking conversations on climate change and sustainability. My name is Marie-Céline, and I'm your host for this fourth and last episode of the Around the World series. In this series of episodes, we want to showcase the diversity of the current cohort that's studying the Climate Change Management and Finance Masters at Imperial College. So far, you've been able to explore with Imperial students from 9 different countries about their perspectives on impacts and adaptation, nature-based solution, and transitioning away from fossil fuels. This final episode will focus on the policy side of climate change mitigation, and I am very pleased to be joined by Shakira, Chong, Kushbu, and Gabriella, coming respectively from Malaysia, China, India, and the USA. Before we dive into the discussion, can you please, guys, give a quick introduction about yourself, of your background, and tell me about your favorite outdoor place or activities? So, Shakira, do you want to go first?
Thanks, Marie-Céline. Thanks for having me today. I'm also a fellow CCMF student. Before CCMF, I've been working in investments and policy, and mainly focused on climate and energy policy. I worked with the government, I've worked with like a public-private sector, and I'm looking forward to discussion today. My favorite outdoor activity is hiking, just going in the mountains, and yeah, looking forward to do more in the UK, hopefully.
Amazing. Thank you. So nice to have you here. Chong, do you want to continue?
Sure, thanks. So before CCMF, I did undergrad in accounting in Reading, and then after that, my interest in ESG generated during my bachelor research project. And for my favorite outdoor activity, actually, just the same as Shakira, it's also hiking and traveling. So I find hiking and traveling sometimes a very good way to spot or witness some evidence of climate change. Thank you.
We have a very outdoorsy podcast here. Amazing. Kushbu, what about you?
Hi, everyone. I'm Kushbu. I'm from India. I'm also studying the CCMF course. And before the course, I was working in India in the whole tech startup scene. I have spent more like almost half a decade in the sustainability eco space. And that's why I'm very passionate to, you know, work on climate change right now. And my favorite activity is to swim. I love the beach. And I think swimming the beach actually really keeps me calm and very excited.
I love that. Thank you, Kushbu. And finally, Gabriella, up to you.
Hi, so yes, I'm Gabriella from the US. And prior to this master's program, I worked in risk management for a few years and then also worked at an ESG software company as a consultant for them. And I'd say my favorite outdoor activity recently has been running, training for a marathon. So definitely getting familiar with all of the outdoor parts of London.
Amazing. Refreshing to hear a part about London, which is also a beautiful city. So fantastic. Thank you, guys. So this episode will be structured around 3 main topics. First one being the impact of upcoming elections in 2 of our represented countries. So I'm talking, of course, about India and the United States. So Gabriella, my first question is for you. Recent polls show little defense for Donald Trump against Joe Biden in the presidential elections. So what do you think can be the impact of this 2024 election on environmental policy in the US?
Very good question. And I know there's lots of people that are really eager to see what happens with this election. And just so to provide some background, the U.S. is the largest emitter of carbon in history, and currently it's the second largest emitter after China. So what happens when it comes to climate and climate policy is really important for kind of the state of the world. And also compared to some other countries and the EU, the U.S. is quite behind when it comes to climate action and climate policy, and it's quickly falling behind on its 2030 emissions target of reducing emissions by 50 to 52% below 2005 emissions. So since there are 2 candidates, Biden and Trump, who are currently president or were formerly president, we can kind of look to see what they've done in the past to kind of get a glimpse of what we should be expecting if either of them are reelected. So during the Trump presidency, it was quite a roller coaster, to say the least, when it came to climate-related issues. Just a few points. He withdrew from the Paris Agreement. He loosened many environmental regulations that were put in place by the Obama administration, tried and failed to prop up the coal industry, and just overall really hasn't shown much support when it comes to climate science and climate policy. So if he's elected as president again, he's hinted that he'll weaken climate regulations again and kind of look to weaken the Inflation Reduction Act that was put in place by Biden and kind of expand oil and gas initiatives. But a slight positive to if he's elected is that it's unlikely that he will be able to override the Inflation Reduction Act just because it's an official law. So Congress would have to put in a lot of work to kind of roll back these efforts. And also because the Inflation Reduction Act has created a lot of jobs and boosted the economy, it's hopeful that we can kind of continue to see that play out just because there's other benefits outside of just climate. And then turning more to the Biden administration, there was a lot of many positive pushes for climate. He rejoined the Paris Agreement that Trump withdrew from. As mentioned, the Inflation Reduction Act was passed during his presidency, and this was really, really huge because it mobilizes massive investment in clean energy through tax credits at the industry and individual level. And it's resulted in a lot of new jobs in clean tech and advancements in renewable technologies and the mobilization of private sector financing. But we've also seen a lot of oil production through the Biden administration, including approvals of oil drilling projects on federal land, as well as other pipelines kind of being approved to go forward with construction. So pros and cons to both presidents being re-elected, but there's definitely more hope when it comes to Biden as a re-election. Lastly, sorry, I feel like I'm rambling a lot, but I think when it comes to the election, I think the biggest impact of the Trump administration, which we're kind of still seeing today, is the politicization of climate change that we aren't really seeing to the same extent in other countries. And this politicization kind of is slowing down climate progress and climate urgency. So I think that's another thing to kind of take into consideration as we head towards this election.
Thanks, Gabriela. Very interesting. Thank you for this comprehensive overview of both potential presidents, and especially your last point about the politicization
of climate issues.
The polarization around it, because I think it really increases skepticism regarding the science behind it. So that's, kind of the alarming aspect for me. So Khushbu, up to you. So there will be elections in India as well in 2024. What is your take on these upcoming elections? Because I think that the BJP, which is Narendra Modi's party, is quite confident to win. So what will be the impact on environmental policy, especially, for India, which is one of the most impacted countries regarding climate change effects?
Yeah, it's a very valid question. I think 2024 is the election year. So 2024 is almost the midway point to the 2030 agenda, a year by when scientists say that Earth should have halved its greenhouse gas emissions. But India saw extreme weather events almost every day from Jan to September 2023, which has become the new abnormal in the warming world. So the Indian government in the last decade has passed contentious environmental laws like the Forest Conservation Bill and the Biodiversity Bill, which were described as a disaster for the country's forests and forest-dependent people. But parties have, however, weaved in green policies, renewable energy targets, and pollution-free mandates into their election manifestos. While the promise of positive climate change could work in a party's favor in the upcoming 2024 elections, it will have to be complemented with mainstream commitments such as economic development and health. So climate change appeared in the election manifestos of major national parties, including BJP and Congress, for the first time in 2019. And the green agenda for several parties have been focusing on air pollution, protecting forests and water bodies, and transitioning to renewable energy. But between 2014 and 2024, India's leadership at G20 and its growing prominence in the international forums, such as the COP, has also influenced the domestic political narrative and pushed to integrate climate goals into the national policies. Now, the Narendra Modi-led BJP, which is widely expected to return for a third consecutive term, has made ambitious decarbonization pledges, announced new national strategies to develop clean fuels, provide incentives for clean energy investors, and has also commissioned clean energy infrastructure projects. But while they're doing this, they're also accelerating import of dirty fuels and focusing heavily on domestic coal production. Coal still dominates India's energy mix, with industry producing it so rapidly that the Indian coal minister announced that the country intends to start exporting it by 2026. And India's carbon tax is also among one of the world's lowest, and many companies simply swallow the cost without ramping up renewables. So the climate action trend lines over the third Modi term are not as sanguine as supporters may suggest.
Thank you, Kushbu, for that nuanced answer. It's true that, you know, India has really ambitious renewable energy targets, but they haven't made any pledges to exit coal or like to at least reduce coal production. So quite a contrasted stocktake of the current political landscape. So thank you for that. This concludes the election part of this episode. And now I want to dive a little bit into the policy landscapes in our represented countries. So turning to you, Shakira, I know that Malaysia has had a cabinet overhaul in late 2023. So namely with the creation of an energy transition ministry, which has been separated from the environment ministry. So some observers say that potentially this signals the country's attention to mitigate its target under the national roadmap. Do you think this new ministry signals a higher ambition for Malaysia?
So I have been working in the private and public sector for quite a while before coming here, so I'm more pessimistic than the average. For me, it may not just be like a higher ambition signal, but it is more importantly how climate transition is becoming a lot more important in the government and how Malaysia wants to portray itself in the global energy landscape. So a little background on the energy sector in Malaysia. It's not anywhere in any articles that you'll find, but in the industry, we always have known that energy sector has like two childs, one very favorite child by the government and one kind of like a stepchild. Maybe it's important, maybe it's not important. So our favorite child has been our oil and gas sector, which is governed under a specific law. It's called Petroleum Development Act 1975. This allows this sector to be directly under the control of Prime Minister and Prime Minister Department. Why this was made is because this child, which is our petroleum industry, is so important to the government. In 2019, from a study by Khazanah Research Institute, oil and gas sector represents around 31% of government revenue, which compared to other countries is pretty high. And they're paying the government based on dividends and royalties and tax and so on and so forth. So we've always known like energy sector, a lot of policies is slightly more governed towards enabling fossil fuels just because it has been profitable for the government. And then the last favorite child is everything else that is more like public goods sector, right? Like electricity, water, environment, everything else. So the fact that to me, they combined almost these two big chunks, electricity and energy, into an energy transition ministry, it signals that, oh, maybe we should look at electricity and climate change more importantly and more seriously. Before this, they were giving to politicians that are like, you know, in every country in policy making, you know the importance if they give it to a more high-ranking politicians. So they were giving energy or electricity to the lower-ranking politicians, which you can see, like economy ministry is like higher ranking, and then electricity is always some politicians that is less well-known. What I'm happy about is that from the global landscape of climate transition, you know, all the talks, whether it's a public sector talks or the private sector, which means like investments in climate, it has pushed the government to rethink its role in climate change and energy transition, which is really good because now it's not about targets in climate change, but it's about implementing climate change. And
whether our ambition is how many percentage renewable energy, we should be able to focus it as a key priority, even though we're a developing country compared to the UK and the US, etc. So yeah, hopefully it will be better implementation.
Very interesting take. Thanks, Shakira. So for you, this doesn't mean an increased ambition, but rather a shift in priorities and strategy. So very insightful. And talking about strategy, I want to come to you, Chong, about the current landscape in China. So China's strategy in policymaking is outlined in 5-year national economic and development plans. So the current one being from 2021 to 2025. What is their current strategy and how does the environmental element fit in this? And maybe a follow-up question is how does the country's centralized policymaking help China implement this strategy?
Thanks, MC, for your great questions. So the 5-year plan might be one of the most representative examples of the country's centralized policymaking, which adopts a top-down approach. It's ingrained in the nature of the economic system and centralized politic system that the Chinese government is very good at focusing resources on the sectors that it wants to grow. And any 5-year plan, it serves as the highest level of blueprint of what are these sectors. So I would like to share something interesting about the 14th 5-year plan, which is the current one compared to the previous one. There's a new developed concept raised, which combines the sustained healthy economic development with the obvious improvement in quality and efficiency, which is at the center of the 14th 5-year plan. It is aimed to achieve higher quality, more efficiency, more fairness, and more sustainable and safer development. This is an evolution from the previous one, where the aim was appropriate development, with economic development treated as the central, and where the first of the majority objectives was to maintain a medium high rate of growth. Also, the current 5-year plan listed 20 either indicative or binding targets across 5 main aspects, including like economic development, innovation, people's well-being, green ecology, as well as the security and safety. So targeting regarding the green ecology are all binding rather than indicative. However, there are less targets in both absolute numbers and relative weight compared to the previous 5-year plan. And these targets, they are focused more on capping energy and carbon intensity per unit of GDP and air and water quality, as well as the forest coverage rate. So to be more specific, as for the energy sector, Chinese sectoral 14th 5-year plan set out a range of mitigation measures to prepare the country for a post-coal transition, and the country is on track to meet its energy sector targets. So in early 2021, a shift from coal initially appeared to be a political priority as the president announced that China would strictly control coal consumption over the 2021 to 2025 period and gradually phase down consumption thereafter. However, there remains some uncertainty about whether the accelerator of renewables will be sufficient to meet the growth in energy demand and really reduce their dependence on coal and gas at the same time. Well, so that means like there's a possibility that fossil fuel dependence will continue, even though the renewables, they're also like being deployed at a very rapid pace. And regarding to the second question, speaking of how centralized policies would impact China's implementation of a strategy, there are definitely pros and cons, like a lot of them on both sides. So on one hand, the centralization aims to unify the government and the nation under the party and deliver aspirations of the top, no matter it's regarding enhancing the strengths or avoiding what's perceived as shortcomings. And as I just mentioned, it means that the Chinese government is focusing on certain sectors that it indicated in the plans. And this centralization really helped to concentrate and pour good amount of resources in these sectors. So some vivid examples would be like the EV sectors and solar panel industries, where the success largely down to the favorable government policies that have encouraged investment in these sectors. However, on the other hand, centralization of decision-making power could reduce adaptability of low-level government and encourage the reliance on policy approach that are already suited the low, the bottom base level. So it carries the risk to overlook the voice from the bottom. Also, it may hinder the mobility of market in some cases. And these are really some key risks to bear in mind. So overall, China's International Climate Pledge, which is also refers to the NDC, National Determined Contribution, is to peak CO2 emission before 2030 and to reduce the intensity by over 65% from 2005 levels. Well, given some current analysis based on consumption rather than production, the both targets are likely to be significantly overachieved, which means the additional coal capacity being built now will lead to growing stranded asset risk. Meanwhile, it also suggests that more ambitious goal about emission reduction should be encouraged.
Thanks, Chong. So very complete answer. You mentioned electric vehicles, so we'll come back to that point a bit later in the discussion, but also a really important component of China's strategy. And, you know, it's particularly important for China to deliver on its ambition, given that it's the most important country in terms of annual emissions. So there is no climate change mitigation without China's input. So that's quite good news that you're saying that the targets are expected to be met. I want to turn back to you, Gabriela. We've talked a lot about centralization. So an example of decentralized policymaking would be the US. And we've seen a recent anti-ESG backlash in 2023 with the introduction of bills that are basically fighting the use of ESG criteria to assess investment opportunities and risks, or even trying to ban fossil fuel divestment. So what is your take on that step back under the Biden administration? And how do you think that the decentralized policy making is impacting the US environmental policy?
Yeah, really great question. And I think this ties back into the polarization that I was discussing earlier when it came to the previous administration. And to touch on the anti-ESG movement, in 2023, we saw around 165 anti-ESG bills that were proposed in 37 different states. And these proposed bills look to limit state fund managers' use of ESG data, or also punish those who boycotted certain industries that would have negative effects on climate. And this is according to the Principles for Responsible Investment. And one extreme example was in Florida, where the governor signed a bill that prevents state officials from investing public funds into ESG-related goals and ESG-related bond sales. So even with all of this movement happening with the anti-ESG movement, not many of these bills were actually approved. Out of the 165 that were proposed, only about 15% were approved. But with all of this happening, it kind of creates a lot of media around these bills and kind of curbs progress around ESG activity at the state and federal level. And I think with the decentralized policy throughout different states, it kind of creates this frenzy and discredits the true purpose and impact of ESG. And it makes it really challenging for investors and organizations and other stakeholders to navigate this landscape where state by state, everything is quite different. And so I think there's a lot of hesitation when it comes to investing in ESG due to this. But we are starting to see a bit more centralization when it comes to climate policy in the US, which is really exciting. March 6th of this year, the Securities and Exchange Commission passed the SEC climate disclosure. And this was a long-awaited bill to be passed in the US. We've been waiting on it since, I believe, 2022. And it will require large accelerated filers and accelerated filers to disclose their scope 1 and scope 2 emissions starting in 2026, as well as some other climate related disclosures. And it's a bit rolled back from the initial proposal. I'm sure you've noticed it does not include scope 3 emissions, which is not great, but I think it's progress in the right direction. And hopefully we can continue to see more progress around this.
Thank you. It's important to take a step back, you know, and distance ourselves sometimes from kind of the media picture, which can seem very pessimistic, and to highlight the actual outcome and the progress made. So we actually talked about the SEC disclosure rule in the CCMF class. So very good news that this was actually adopted. And the US is also making some remarkable progress in electric vehicles manufacturing. So I said we would come back to it, which has increased by 70% in 2023 and is now representing 12% of all vehicles produced for sales in the US. And I know that you're from Georgia, which is an important EV manufacturing state, while being a conservative state. Why do you think that EV manufacturing is so important in Georgia?
Yeah, so it was a really exciting time to live in Georgia over the past few years, just as we've seen a lot of change and push for EV manufacturing. And I think the real big pull here is just the economic opportunities and the job opportunities. And this is all due to the Inflation Reduction Act, which I mentioned earlier. So because of all these different tax incentives, Georgia has been working to make its name for itself as a leader in US EV manufacturing. And the governor actually stated that since 2020, Georgia has recruited more than 40 EV-related projects, which has accounted for around 28,000 additional new jobs and almost $23 billion in anticipated investment. So this is really huge, I think, for any state in general, but in particular, a state that tends to be a bit more conservative and slow to adopt certain climate policies and investments. And this EV investment in Georgia has brought a lot of new business and jobs and kind of put it on the global market as a contributor to EV production. Hyundai Motor Group is one of the biggest investors in Georgia. They are working on building a Meta plant, which is almost a $6 billion investment, with about 8,000 new jobs being created. And this is to produce new electric vehicles. And Hyundai is also partnering with LG and investing an additional $4.3 billion to build a new EV battery manufacturing plant, which will also create around 3,000 new jobs. And so states like Georgia, it's proof that ESG and sustainability, it's a clear win, not just for the environment, but I think also for the businesses and people. And supporting a transition to a greener economy, it creates jobs, it supports energy independence, and can reduce costs for the state and for businesses and individuals within the state. So I think, you know, there's value to climate work outside of just doing good for the environment. And by having these co-benefits, it can really incentivize states or maybe countries who are a bit more hesitant to adopt climate-related initiatives to really take them and embrace them, really.
Mm-hmm. Really good example, as you say, of sort of a ESG success story that combines job creation, you know, economic outcomes and environmental progress. So that's quite a good example of how we shouldn't leave out the job creation narrative out of the transition, of course. And electric vehicle is also a huge topic for air pollution. And I know that India is particularly suffering from very high air pollution levels in cities like Delhi, for example. And Delhi has put in place a electric vehicle policy, which aims to raise the share of electric vehicles up to 25% by 2024. So I'm turning to you, Khushbu. There is a displayed high ambition for electric vehicles. Have you been able maybe to see infrastructure following and real EV uptake?
Yeah, absolutely. I think India is high on the electric vehicle scene right now. So the government of India had announced ambition energy transition plans at the COP26, saying it will deploy about 500 gigawatts of renewable energy generation capacity by 2030. And it even signed up for the global EV 30 at 30 campaign. So here the renewable plan would triple India's renewable capacity. And the campaign calls for electric vehicles to make up at least 30% of new vehicle sales by 2030. The EV uptake in India has rose sharply in 2022, with electric car sales quadrupling to 48,000 vehicles from 12,000 in 2021. And even the two-wheeler segment has reached 7%, and the three-wheeler has reached 55%. and one of the world's largest two-wheeler and three-wheeler factories is being built in Tamil Nadu. So the government of India supports EV deployment through the faster adoption and manufacturing of hybrid and EV, which is called the FAME scheme, aiming to reduce primary oil consumption and pollution in cities, creating battery and EV manufacturing capacity at global scale, and also introducing subsidies for electric vehicles by exempting them for registration fees and road taxes. The government think tank, Niti Aayog, and Ministry of Power, they have also released a handbook which guides the EV charging infrastructure for authorities in planning and realizing the charging infrastructure. And even the public charging infrastructure has seen a jump from 900 publicly accessible chargers in 2021 to almost 11,000. And we are aiming for about 2,800 by 2024. Recently, in her pre-election budget speech, the finance minister, Ms. Nirmala Sitharaman, also signaled greater adoption of electric buses for public transport networks and blending of compressed biogas into compressed natural gas for transport as mandatory. At the same time, I think a lot of focus is also on how the consumers are kind of, you know, realizing this. And EVs have become increasingly accessible. The incumbent car manufacturers have announced ambitious product portfolio electrification targets. Newcomers have launched models specifically designed for India's urban environments. And the consumer sentiment suggests that the transition to EV will gain momentum. A vast majority of people are eyeing EVs for their next car purchase. So I think overall, the environment is building up towards a very good EV uptake in the country.
That's amazing. Those are very positive outlooks. Thank you, Kashbu. And especially seeing, you know, policy being translated into consumer habits and actually a real uptake in electric vehicles. So that's very positive, as this would have, you know, not only impacts on greenhouse emissions, but also on the quality of air in cities. So that's huge progress. And of course, we cannot talk about electric vehicles without mentioning China, which is today leading the electric vehicle manufacturing sector. So Chong, I'm turning to you. You've talked about the electric vehicle manufacturing sector in the five-year national plan. So what was the role of public policy in establishing this market leadership position?
Yeah, it's really an interesting topic, as the Chinese industry is growing at a speed that surprised most observers. So in 2023, China's EV sale expanded by 38% to 9.49 million units, accounting for like about 31% market share, and with an overseas sale growth of 12%. Currently, the government have always been playing an important role in it, from propping up both the supply of it and the demand. As a result of generous government subsidies, tax break, and procurement contracts, as well as other policy incentives, a slew of homegrown EV brands have emerged and continue to optimize new technologies so they can meet the real-life needs of consumers. This in turn has cultivated a large group of young car buyers. So what the government has done exactly, start from as far as in 2000s years. Before it fully ventured into the field of EV, China's car industry was in an awkward position where there was no domestic ban that could one day rival the foreign makers. So this pushed the Chinese government to break away from the established technology and invest in EV, even if the risks were extremely high and there were only like niche experiments back then. So the Chinese government took initial step to invest in EV technology as early as 2001 by introducing it as a research priority in China's five-year plan. And then in 2007, the industry got a significant boost when Wang Gong became the Minister of Science and Technology in China, who had been a big fan of EV and tested the Tesla's first EV model in 2008, the year it was released. So people now credit Wang as the one who made the national decision to go all into the EV. Since then, EV has become constantly prioritized in China's national economic planning. And I think another driver, as mentioned by Kushbu in the India EV's emergence, is that the air quality, which I believe that it's further encouraged the investment in EV industry. After that, starting in 2009, the country began handling out financial subsidies to EV companies for producing buses, taxis, or cars for individual customers. From 2009 to 2020, the government borrowed over about 200 billion RMB, which is about $29 billion, into relevant subsidies and tax break. While the subsidy policy officially ended at the end of 2020, it was replaced by a more market-oriented system called dual credits. It had been like reached the intended effect, which is more than 6 million EVs sold in China in 2020, accounted for over about half of global sales. So apart from that, the government also helped domestic EV companies stay afloat in their early years by handing out procurement contracts. Around 2020, before the consumer market accept EV, the first ones in China was part of its vast public transportation system. So there were yet other state policies that encourage individuals to purchase EV. In popular cities like Beijing, car licenses have been rationed for more than a decade, and it can still take time, like years or thousands of dollars, to get one for a gas car. But the process has basically been waived for people who decided to purchase EV, which serves as a huge incentive for individuals. Finally, local government also have sometimes worked closely with EV companies to customize policies that can help the latter grow. For example, BYD, which is a Chinese company currently challenging Tesla's dominance in EV, rose up by keeping a close relationship with the southern city, which is Shenzhen, and making its first city in the world to completely electrify its public bus fleet.
Fantastic. Really comprehensive overview of the whole process and how China developed the EV sector. I think it's another interesting example after India of how public policy creates an environment for businesses with subsidies, procurement contracts, and that after translates into consumption habits and also public transportation schemes and kind of the daily lives of people with improved air quality. So that's really interesting. Thank you for that kind of story that you unfolded for us. Moving on to Shakira, I also want to talk about Malaysia's renewable energy program, which is called the Malaysia Renewable Energy Roadmap. And it was created in 2023 to kind of outline the measures that the government needs to take to reach its net zero emission targets by 2050. So how do you think that will impact the electricity supply market in Malaysia? What is your take on this roadmap?
I think we have a new target, right? Like you said, in 2023. 40% of RE by 2035 and 70% by 2050. Just for context, this has changed quite a bit. I think maybe 3-4 times in the past few years due to the change of government. So a new minister comes in and he or she wants a different target. And it's been quite hard to kind of like keep track on what it means. Why this target they like to change is also because electricity is a little bit more politicized than oil and gas. Because electricity in Malaysia is a public goods industry. It's not a commoditized industry. So like the government's kind of one of its role is to make sure the tariff remains as low as possible. So in this 40% by 2035 means it will be around 18 gigawatt of renewable energy. But remember, this includes also small hydro apart from solar. So right now, I think we have around 2 gigawatt of solar. Compared to 18 gigawatt of like renewable energy, it's very, very small. And our solar capacity factor is only around 21%. So the RE potential in Malaysia is solar and with that small capacity factor and hydro, which is quite limited. So in my opinion, an installed capacity target is a little bit like it's a target, but what does it actually mean? Because installed capacity doesn't mean it's the same as generation capacity, which means even if you have this many solar, it doesn't mean this many solar is generating electricity as much as it could. So giving you a context, right, in 2021, solar represented around 15.8% of capacity, but it only represented less than 1% of generation, which means the kilowatt hour generated by fossil fuel is 99% of the whole grid generation. So even if you add more solar, does it really impact your CO2 emission?
if we're still burning, you know, more coal and gas in order to mitigate the intermittency of solar due to its lower capacity factor. So I struggle with this kind of target, actually, in Malaysia. Having said that, it is obviously a good move to, you know, add more and more solar, add more and more hydro, because you're reducing your reliance on fossil fuels. But unless there's a, you know, something in technology that increases the capacity factor, maybe with the help of batteries, this will still be an expensive option to truly decarbonize for a developing country. And in terms of, like, I think maybe about the whole industry itself, it used to be quite a monopoly. Like, it was a monopoly of coal and gas companies. Maybe we have only three electricity generation companies that's producing electricity from coal and gas. But with solar energy, the good thing is that you'll see more smaller players coming in, and hopefully we'll see, you know, more competitive industry, and maybe it will also help with reducing costs.
Thank you, Shakira. So very interesting take on, you know, it's important to have targets, but not to actually lose sight of what we're looking for, which is decarbonization and increased production of renewable energy. And an interesting option to increase the uptake of renewable while having reliable energy production would be nuclear power. So nuclear energy is really interesting for coal-intensive economies like India and Malaysia. So Shakira, what do you think is the potential for Malaysia to develop nuclear energy?
Well, from my previous response, I think I'm very excited about the potential of nuclear power in a country like Malaysia. This is not just because I did nuclear engineering in my previous undergrad, so I'm completely biased, but that means I'm completely rational because I understand it. So in a country with like a limited RE generation potential and with very high concerns of electricity, we don't want our electricity to, you know, I mean, the UK over COVID, you experienced how many X times, right, the electricity cost. So it's still very sensitive in Malaysia. So we need a reliable source of power, like you said recently. And nuclear is a great option for this. And the good thing is, recently, is also an issue that has been politicized in Malaysia. One prime minister likes nuclear, one prime minister doesn't like nuclear, and then the other prime minister comes. So for the nuclear people in Malaysia, we're like, what is happening? But the good thing is about the new government here, they have not ruled out the role of nuclear for now. In my opinion, the good thing about energy, I mean, from other industries, is that it is very objective. Like, you know, if you put this technology, you understand how many gigawatt you need to install to produce how many gigawatt hour of electricity and how many ton of CO2 that you will be producing from doing this. So for nuclear, if you put 1 gigawatt of a fission plant, you will get around 92% capacity factor, which means that in layman terms, it will run around 100% of the time out of the whole 1 gigawatt of the fission plant, and then you get zero CO2. So the math really adds up. And for countries who is a bit more limited with RE, this is a great option, right? And we also need to remind ourselves, especially in developing countries, kind of like conversations like, oh, can we actually do it? Will it be safe? Etc. etc. We have seen both developing countries and developed countries kind of implementing nuclear in a safe way. If you've seen the nuclear management in Sweden, in their nuclear waste facility, it was pristine. And these are the technologies that is actually available and ready to be used and ready to be implemented, but most of the time, unfortunately, being politicized. So we should not rule this out, because climate change is a race against time. We're not against people. We're just running out of time to do this. And if you can do this now, we should not, you know, rule this out. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. What a powerful statement. Thank you, Shakira. Especially your pointing on actually efficiency and capacity factor of nuclear, which is tremendously bigger than, unfortunately, solar energy. And up to you, Kushabu. I know that nuclear power is also quite a priority for India's strategy. How do you see nuclear energy play out in the decarbonization of the Indian economy?
Yeah, so actually on the energy front, India is stuck between a rock and a hard place.
in 2022-23, its power demand was met through 56% from coal, lignite, and gas. And renewables such as hydel, solar, and bioenergy, wind, they accounted for approximately 40%. But as India decarbonizes, not only will most of these thermal units be wound down, the country will also see additional demand for electricity as other users of hydrocarbons like factories and vehicles electrify as well. So by 2050, the energy needed would be almost tenfold jump from today. And the role of nuclear power is becoming more and more evident now. So the India's Ministry of Environment, Forest and Climate Change Low Carbon Development Strategy, it aims to triple the nuclear power capacity by 2032. And India is inviting private firms to invest about $26 billion in its nuclear energy sector to increase the amount of electricity from the sources that don't produce carbon dioxide emission. So currently, nuclear power contributes to less than 2% of India's total electricity generation. And the funding would actually help it to achieve its target of having 50% installed electric generation capacity by 2030, up from 42% now. Even just earlier this month, during the French President Macron's visit to India, the country heads, they signed a joint commitment to combat climate change and advance clean energy from solar, green hydrogen, to nuclear power advancements. And as you already know, France is a global leader in civilian nuclear energy. They rely heavily on nuclear reactors to produce 65 to 70% of its electricity. And this collaboration could actually benefit the goal realization for India. So that's when I want to kind of, you know, wrap it up saying that climate change is again a global issue and global partnerships will actually help, you know, individual countries realize their emission targets.
Fantastic. Thank you, Kushabu, for these insights and also, you know, reminding that climate change is indeed a global issue and it's not nations against nations and that collaboration is always the way to go. So thank you so much, guys. I think this concludes our last episode of the Around the World series. I hope you enjoyed the series as much as we enjoyed creating it. And I really want to thank you guys for coming onto the podcast and sharing those fascinating insights on your home country. So thank you, Kushbu, Chong, Gabriela, and Shakira. It's really an honor to be part of such a diverse and brilliant cohort of people. So thanks so much for taking part in the project.
Thank you so much for hosting everything, MC.
Thank you. And to anyone listening, if you'd like to hear more insights, more subjects, and more professionals, do not forget to subscribe to the Imperial Business Podcast channel. And if you have any suggestions or if you know the perfect guest for us to interview, please drop us a message at podcast.greenminds@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening and see you soon.